Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. It is time for the week in IndyCar, and I'm so glad that we have back my friend and IndyCar rookie, Zach Veach. Tell us about putting together a giant fish tank on your second or third day off after being on the road for seemingly a year straight.
Yeah, I've managed in about a span of 4 weeks to go from a 10-gallon freshwater tank just getting my feet wet to being talked into getting a 75-gallon saltwater tank by my Indy 500 teammate, Stefan Wilson. So I almost got it done. Probably in another 3 weeks, so I have some water in it. So I'm excited. Not much time home to work on it, though.
Well, hopefully he doesn't talk you into buying a McLaren or something like that, because then we'll know how gullible you truly are. So
that would probably be for Marco, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got about an hour for this episode. I know you are busy. I am busy as well. And we're going to blame you straight away here, Veach, for being as popular as you are between Facebook and Twitter. We have about 50 questions, and that's not an exaggeration. And with a race at Texas to look through and get to as many questions as possible in 60 minutes, I don't think we're going to get to all 50. So we're going to have to bounce around and pick the ones that we really like this week, and apologize up front to those that we did not get to. Let's start off, though, with Texas and the fact that if folks were either there in person or happen to catch the awesome NBCSN broadcast, we'll talk about that in a minute as well, they happen to see a certain Zach Veach going forward in what one person asked one of the questions, the Cheeto-mobile, your car that does actually kind of look like Chester should be driving that. But tell us about at least the early portion of your race where, man, you were making progress.
Yeah, we, just in kind of a nutshell, Texas was honestly the first race where an IndyCar hasn't felt big to me. And I think that kind of showed, I felt right at home with, obviously the car Garrett Mothersett gave me was unbelievable. I mean, we were able to go from 16th to 3rd in the opening stint, and I was having a lot of fun just passing cars, timing things, and just seemed like a lot clicked there. I showed up to Texas even in practice. That was my very first time running there. Even from the get-go, just felt really comfortable, and the car was starting to, like, move around, and I felt on top of it just like I did in Indy Lights. So it was a really nice weekend for us, and unfortunately, I got a little too eager and got the wall a little bit as we started the second stint, which bent a right rear toe link. So had to come in the pits, fix that, went 10 laps down, but I'm thankful they got me out because I still learned a ton from the beginning of the night to the end. And honestly, I wish we could go back because I am 100% confident saying we would have finished in the top five, you know, maybe even top three, or been able to, you know, kind of challenge Alex and Simon and, you know, Dixon. He was kind of in his own league for sure. But I think it would have been a good day for us.
Let's talk about the tire portion of the evening. Before we get into dealing with the tires in the race itself, we saw blistering crop up on Friday in running. Some teams worse off than others. It really jumped up in the evening practice. Firestone, full credit to them. They admitted they were caught out a little bit. The track, the Texas Motor Speedway circuit, was repaved, redone, improved, in ways that really added a lot of grip with the tire that they had come up with. I think that there was just a little bit of a mismatch in the softness of the tire itself, then in combination with a track that was grippier, in combination with a track that was about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. The track itself was blistering, which maybe shouldn't have been a total surprise. The tires would have blistered then running on top of that track surface with that extra grip. They, Friday evening, Zach, and even into Saturday morning, cut open a lot of tires, reported back to everyone that yes, while the blistering is not something they expected to go away in the race, no real concerns about safety, tire blowouts and such. That all proved to be 100% accurate. Nonetheless, you still had to deal with the concerns of blistering. What was that like for you specifically on your Andretti Autosport Honda and how you guys managed it? Because I don't know if I recalled seeing much in the way of blistering on your hot rod.
Yeah, we were very lucky. I think everyone at Andretti, we have really good cars as far as handling and blistering even. You know, with that being said, Firestone did an incredible job allowing us to scuff tires, which just gives a heat cycle on the tire, which hardens it up just a little bit that makes it last longer. So that definitely helped us a long way. And it kind of came down to just how you took care of them. You know, my first stint, with that being the strongest we had, we really didn't have much blistering because I was able to kind of be on my own, you know, pass a car, charge the next pass. But when I came back out on the second stint, I was kind of deeper in the field because we had a little bit of a slow stop, I think running 11th, and we had about three cars in front of us. And with that dirty air and my kind of rookie ignorance of pushing super, super hard, in about 5 to 10 laps, I blistered the right front to a point where we had to come in because it wasn't a safety concern. Firestone did a great job with that. We didn't have to worry about any tires, you know, failing or anything. But we just had a tremendous loss of grip on that right front just because we basically cooked it. So, you know, it goes a long way on the car that you had, how easy it was on the tires. As a driver, you were trying to do whatever you could with your tools inside the car to get all the weight off the right front and try to get it to the left front to make it last. But yeah, it's just how you went about it, how well you took care of them.
So this is maybe a cruel way to put it, but it's the way my brain works, and I make no apologies for that. Zach, tell us about, with this blistering issue in mind, one that, again, wasn't super prevalent in your evening other than what you just described, but it was for some other teams, some other drivers who really it seemed like were just stuck in a blistering nightmare. As a driver, are you watching, looking, observing, looking for those cars in front of you almost like wounded animals? Like, aha, I see one or two, you know, obviously the tires are rotating. You can't see the individual blisters, but I see those strips, you know, the little bands that tell me, aha, so-and-so up, you know, 2, 3, 10 car lengths ahead. Are you looking at them like wounded animals, like, ooh, I gotcha? Or how's your mind working, knowing that everyone's probably dealing with the same thing?
You definitely keep your eyes open during the practice day. You know, you're just kind of peeking, you know, to see, you know, how each individual tires are looking. You know, we were definitely stronger than others. So in your mind, you have that checklist, you know, as you're coming up on a certain team car, you're like, yes, they've had a bad blistering problem. So if it's early in the stint and you're like, okay, I just need to bide my time here for about 5 laps, then, you know, they'll start to show their weaknesses. And you can't really see the blister on the tire itself as you're going so fast, but you can start seeing characteristics of the car in front of you change. I think a lot of people were struggling with that right front going off, and where you would see that is the exit of turn two. So, you know, you would pinch it in under them a little bit to get some clean air on that left front end plate. And you would just kind of see in the middle of the corner of them just kind of barely just come off the apex and can't really hold it down. And once you see that a few times, you're like, okay, that's only going to get worse for them. So you just start timing your passes accordingly and, you know, kind of looking 5 laps ahead. And I think in IndyCar, that's been the big thing of just trying to see how the race is going to unfold 5 to 10 laps from where you are in that exact position. And it's easy for the guys that have been doing it for 15 years, but when you're doing it, you know, you're seeing it for the first time or the second time, you know, you have a lot going on that you're trying to pay attention to.
Yeah, it is another data point, obviously. Again, it is something that as you're able to, you can spot the weaknesses that are either developing. Granted, there's also the other obvious one, and that is if someone was having big problems with blistering, they were probably not cranking out 247-mile-an-hour laps. They were probably running off the pace a little bit. But again, at least if you're sitting behind somebody trying to work on them for a while, could be one of the telltale signs that something might be going awry. Obviously,
exactly.
You were in the race, Zach, so I'm sure you didn't. Well, it would have been cool, actually, if you had your phone and some wireless going, watching the NBCSN broadcast from inside the car. But had you, you would have seen that the three Team Penske Chevys that qualified an emphatic 1-2-3 had brutal nights centered on blistering. And I didn't do an accounting of every single car and then rank who was best to worst in that regard, but I can at least say that by looking at the broadcast when I got home, you know, watching it when I got home from Texas and looking at some of the images that they showed, boy, it looked like the Penske drivers, be it their right fronts, right rear tires, maybe even both, were in pretty sorry shape across pole sitter Joseph Newgarden, Simon Pagenaud, Will Power. Part of me wonders, not saying this is accurate, Zach, but part of me wonders, when you start seeing that much blistering across the entire tire carcass, inside, middle, and outside, I start to wonder if A, camber is a little bit more than was optimal for tire life, possibly tire inflation a little bit more than might have been optimal. It just seemed like, again, this is my, trying to use a little bit of experience, but this is my looking at the three Penske entries, seeing that all three had similar problems of excessive blistering, and wondering if they might have been just a little bit aggressive on suspension settings. Is that something you think, if you might have seen their tires either after the race or on track, something that could have caught them out?
Without a doubt. I think, you know, everything, your tire is basically telling you, you know, the whole story of the car.
Yep.
Just from temperatures. If, you know, your right rear is hotter than your right front, odds are you're sliding the right rear more than the right front. So, you know, that kind of seeing where the blisters are is giving you the trend of how their car is handling. And Firestone, they do such a good job of telling us when we get to a race weekend if they're having any problems like that. They kind of limit, you know, what our camber range is, what they think, because they understand the tire a lot better than we do. They understand, you know, how much camber is going to be too much for this tire, how much camber is going to create problems, what tire pressures you probably should be in, just because, you know, as inflation increases, that increases, you know, certain areas on the tire that's more likely to blister.
The balloon's bigger. Yep.
Exactly. So Firestone does an incredible job of telling us exactly where, you know, we should be for each given given event. And, you know, that's something my engineer and I was talking about is, you know, the guys that seem to have blinding speed in qualifying didn't tend to have that longevity in the race. And that honestly has to come down to something like tire pressures and cambers, because you're using so much of the tire to put in, you know, two magical laps, that when you try to put that same setup kind of in race conditions, it just wears out what you have a lot quicker than something that's a little more conservative and set up for the long haul.
And we should also mention here, for those who might be fans of Formula One and IndyCar, there is a difference rule-wise, whereas in Formula One, they have, you know, put in place actual regulations on teams adhering to minimum tire pressures and such that must be used. But essentially, Formula One tries to get very heavy into the policing or enforcing the recommendations of Pirelli, their tire manufacturer. In IndyCar, we have a bit of a different dynamic where Firestone, as you pointed out, will say, hey, we think right front camber should not exceed this degree, and we think pressure-wise, this is the maximum where you should go. Those are highly educated and very, very well-studied suggestions, but they are not something that are policed by the rule book to enforce, which means if a team, you know, if Firestone says right front, I'm just picking a random number,
yep,
5 degrees of camber is the maximum, and that's a lot, but let's just say 5 is the maximum we suggest, and a team says, well, we feel like going to 6, that's where we believe is going to be the magic number, you can. And then if your tires blister, or if they, you know, pick a pressure, if you want to go beyond that or well below that, you can. And
yeah,
you know, and then we see tires come off cars during pit stops where you go, it looks like someone with a BB gun in the grandstands was just shooting at your tire, because I haven't seen that many. Like, you would have to work to put that many holes in the sucker. So
whoever that kid was, he was after me that second stint.
Darn you, sure. Kid.
But, you know, it's something that it's team-wide, you know. It's one team kind of gets their idea around a certain setup, and that's what they run. I mean, if we look back, I think it was 2016 or 17, you know, with the Penske's of Phoenix. They're both extremely fast, and I think Castroneves had a left front blow, or his teammate had a left front blow.
Montoya,
you know,
I believe.
After him, Montoya.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, if you're, you know, ragging it, Firestone says, you know, good luck. We don't recommend it, but, you know, you make that decision, and you just hope it's the best. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, you want to listen to the people that are creating the balloons you're riding around on.
Absolutely. Let's jump into a couple other Texas race items, Zach, before we move over to questions, because, again, we got a lot. They're awesome, and I don't want to delay us too much longer. I need to raise my hand. I think I already admitted I got one completely wrong, but now I had two things that I got completely wrong at Texas. The first one was I did a just prior to halfway report or column leading into Texas, looking at some of the major themes up through almost the first half of the year and what we might look forward to the second half. And one of them, I mentioned Honda, where based on Chevy's performance and strengths with top-end power, I certainly did not list Texas as a place where I thought Honda would feature, and that was 100% wrong. And had I been a smarter monkey, I would have realized that, okay, with the reduced downforce, we are indeed going to have more lifting in the corners. We're not just going to be easy flat during the race.
Exactly.
And had we been in higher downforce where you could be flat, then I do think the Chevys probably would have shown that same sort of muscular top-end power and probably put the Hondas in their place. But since there was a lot of lifting, a lot more lifting than we've seen, I don't know, I mean, I'm struggling even to think when we've had that much lifting, Zach, those Hondas, which have proven most demonstrably at Detroit that, hey, coming off a slow corner, just having a ramp back up in the rev range, pulling hard is a big attribute that Honda seems to have gotten right more than anyone. That could be the thing that separates one brand from the other. So, I struck out on that one. Bourdais was telling me, I think on Friday, he's like, no, you idiot. we got something here. And I'm like, man, you know, I'm supposed to be in the business of being smart, but, well, that doesn't always happen. So,
well, so am I. And sometimes, you know, I mess up too. So,
wow. So I got that one completely wrong. The other one, and this is just me raising my hand afterwards, I'm like, damn it, I hate you, Robin Miller. So, as we know, or some of us know, my dear friend and colleague Robin Miller is a degenerate gambler. Well, he's a gambler, but he's also a degenerate, and those two kind of go hand in hand. And so he usually, you know, will play some bets on who might win. I mean, he does this across every form of sport. And Scott Dixon was one of his two picks for the race. One on the Chevy side, one on the Honda side. He chose Dixon for the Honda side. And afterwards, he was just smiling as much as could be. He was like, well, I got that one right. And it just dawned on me, because I never even thought of Dixon before the race, Zach, and I'll ask you for some comments about this in just a sec, but it did occur to me, of course, after the event was over, after Scott dominates the whole thing, where I'm like, okay, well, what are the two big challenges tonight? Well, one is tire management. That's absolutely number one. Well, who has the best car control in the series? I mean, you know, even his closest rivals fawn over him for his car control. Well, that's Scott Dixon. And so car control can be two things, right? It can either be Tokyo drift, smoking tires. Oh, wow, look at him. He can hold this thing sideways. And B, it can also be keeping the car running on the limit, but being so fast with your hands and feet that the thing is never stepping out. You're keeping it dancing on the edge, but without getting out of shape and keeping it in that perfect range. Well, that's what Dixon did. So he put those supreme skills to work. He and his race engineer, Chris Simmons, came up with not only the right setup, but also maintained the right setup window throughout the race. And then the guy did his usual job of saving fuel, so that on top of passing cars on track, he was also making up positions in the pits, because when he would come in to top up, there'd be less fuel needing to go in, because he'd saved more. So you put those two things together, and had I been smart, and Miller, again, absolutely killed me on this one, I probably should have thought that Scott Dixon might have been the guy to go forward and win the thing. So what comes to mind when you see a guy like Scott Dixon applying these two fairly impressive skills, Zach, to, I guess, humble some of the people that at least going into the start of the race we thought might have been the ones to come out up front?
Well, first off, I ran into Robin at Bucky's across from the track as the team and I was getting some refreshments on our way to the airport. And he did seem very happy, so I do believe you when you say he was smiling from ear to ear. But secondly, I personally was humbled to the point of admiration of Scott Dixon on pit end at the end of the first stint. You know, all weekend, the drivers, everyone else has been telling me, you know, how slick pit in is, how, you know, you need to be careful not to slide up on the track.
Yeah,
I'm like, okay, you know, it's in my head. So we have a good first in. I'm like, I'm not going to do anything stupid on pit in. I'm just going to take it easy and we'll build ourselves up the rest of the night. So I'm cruising around trying to get in pit in. With pit in, I'm staring at the cone. And Dixon drives around the outside of me like another 20 mile an hour. And it startled me. You know, you're not expecting someone. Because I'm like, okay, I passed him like three laps ago. I have like a 2 second gap. So this is going to be fine. And then he drives around me and beats me off pit lane. And I'm like, wow, this guy just took me to school. And that's why I tweeted him. I was like, man, thank you. You gave me a lesson. And, you know, I have so much admiration for him and guys like Power and even my own teammates, you know, like Alex, Marco, and Ryan, because, you know, I see half the puzzle. These guys have the entire puzzle, and you see them do stuff like that, and you're just like, wow, I thought I was doing a good job. And then, you know, you step it up again, and next weekend they do something else that's incredible, and it's like, man, how are these guys so good?
Well, that's the fun part of being a rookie, but I appreciate the fact that, you know, that was one of the more incredible visuals from the race. All right, here comes Zach in the pits, and he's getting passed on the apron going into pit lane. But, again, I appreciate the fact that you can look at that and go, all right, another level. Got it. Okay, stepping it up.
If it was another rookie, I would, like, be hanging my head. Like,
yeah.
Man. But when it's Dixon who makes a fool out of you, you're like, huh. Okay, yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about one or two other quick things from the race. Seemed like an event to me where there were a couple of folks who really got what they needed. And if not as a driver, as a team. So I look at Simon Pagenaud, got his best result of the year, finished second, really needed that, moved up to eighth in the standings. Still, I mean, he's going to have a stellar close to the season if he wants to get into the title hunt. I mean, he's, what, 120, 130 points behind Scott Dixon, but that was great for him to get back in the game. I thought a very smart race for him to make the most out of his car, knowing that Newgarden was unable to, had some issues and such, and Power obviously bit of miscommunication there with spotter, basically pit lane and the spotter running over one another, which led him to not seeing Zachary Clayman DeMello coming up behind him. I'm going to ask you about that in a second, but Pagenaud, good for him to get a good result, kind of get back in the game. Been strange not seeing Simon as a force at most rounds this year. I would say if we're just talking purely happiness and, all right, gosh, this guy really, his team might have needed it more than him, that would be James Hinchcliffe finishing fourth after they struggled so heavily to find speed in that car, both at Indianapolis, obviously, but then again, all throughout Friday, really were scratching their heads trying to find something that worked. I know you're in your first year. I know that you are, you know, you're someone who is trying to write your own story here. But I'm guessing, Zach, you also have an appreciation in looking at a guy like Pagenaud and especially Hinchcliffe and going, all right, I wish I finished second, or I wish I finished fourth, but boy, I can still be happy for them knowing they kind of got their years back on track.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's funny. I think out of all the cars I've spent the most time with on track, it's for some reason it's been Pagenaud and I. And, you know, at Barber, at Detroit, at a couple of others. So, you know, knowing with his past and everything, you know, I think he's just been trying to get used to the new car. And for him to finally get that, it really shows, you know, after being kind of in the struggle and, you know, understanding how competitive IndyCar is, you see people do well and you can't be anything but happy for them because you know everyone, the level that it takes to be there. I mean, your best Indy Lights race ever is just good enough to maybe get you inside the top 10. So, you know, it's so difficult, man, you know, to watch these guys have the struggles. And that's part of IndyCar, I think, you know. It's something that it's hard to be on top all the time. So I think, you know, for Hinch especially, you know, seeing him out of the car after the race, he was walking by. And, I mean, he just seemed relieved. He even came up to me, and he's like, man, you had a rocket ship. What happened? You know, it's cool to see, you know, the guys notice that. And we all pay attention to everyone. And I think, you know, there's everybody in the series has so much respect for each other that at the end of the day, you can't be anything but happy. I mean, obviously, when you get beaten for a podium, you're in Hinch's spot. That's tough, but I mean, at the end of the day, a top five in IndyCar is still pretty good.
You are listening to The Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, with rookie Phenom, Zach Veach. All right, dumb radio voice aside, let me ask about this. I don't know if you had a chance to watch the race, see any of the replays. On the topic of that Will Power and Zachary Clayman DeMello crash, I had a little bit of a different take on it than, I guess, what I've read as normal opinion. I've been one of few people, I think, saying that, at least in my profession, saying that I think this Clayman DeMello kid has some real talent and belongs in IndyCar. Again, not saying IndyCar champion talent, because, you know, he would have to prove that, but I don't think the kid is a fish out of water. That was a real question, though, Zach. Coming out of Indy Lights, he had one win. He had sporadic results, right? Would be really up or really down. Wasn't particularly consistent. So coming into this year, fully understand. A lot of question marks. Who is this kid? Does he really belong here? What's he going to do? I don't think he's embarrassed himself by any sense or any stretch. I think if anything, he's done the opposite and impressed with his relative consistency. Texas, to me, was the first race in that crash with Power that I thought he did look like a genuine rookie. So Power accepted blame for the crash, was penalized by IndyCar for that incident, said that it was a crossover between his timing stand and his spotter talking at the same time. Therefore, his spotter could not tell him that Clayman DeMello was coming from behind, and then ensued the crash. At least for me, and I'm not claiming like I have any special powers of observation, Zach, but I was watching the broadcast. I stepped into the media center for about 20 minutes, somewhere after about the 200th lap Saturday night, and just happened to be in a place where I was looking up the monitor, saw the NBCSN footage of the cars coming out of the corner, and could see Clayman DeMello making his first pass, coming up on Power, and it was involuntary. I had a couple folks around me wondering, like, what's wrong with this Pruitt guy? But I started saying, no, because I could see that Zach thought there was clear road ahead of him to go around Power on the outside. But what I saw happening was Power coming out of the corner, being on an arc that was going to carry his car all the way up to, you know, the edge of the barrier and continue on. So at least for what I saw coming, it was Power basically sweeping up the track, the car being on that arc, Zach charging from behind him, thinking it was a wide open space, and not knowing not recognizing, possibly seeing, that he and Power were on converging paths. That's what I saw. Not Will's spotter failing to tell him car high, but if anything, it was Zach just not seeing that the car he was hoping to pass in an open space was on a trajectory that was going to close that space right when he got there. Did you see anything like that, or am I kind of out on an island here?
No, for sure. I think you bring up two really good points. And you know, I've watched the replay just, you know, I'm trying to catch up to see what happened to the race, because you're only focused on, you know, one little piece of real estate. But, you know, I saw two things. You know, first off, I understand why Zach went where he did. You know, you can only pass off of four. The pass starts on turn two, you get the momentum to 3-4. And you have to be able to get around someone, you have to control the car in front of you. So you have to get off four quick enough and get your wing up to their side pod before you get to the dog leg, so their spotter tells them that they have a car high and they have to give you the room. The only way to really pass at Texas is you have to be a little bit of a bully. You got to put yourself in the situation. But, you know, on the other side of that, in IndyCar, one thing that I've really learned is you have to not only pay attention to the car that's in front of you, but you got to think about what's going through the car in front of you's mind. You know, Power was coming up on a car, I think, that was checking up a little bit too. He had a run, you have a run, so sometimes you got to think what the overall trend is going to be. And I think that's just one thing that's easy to forget, especially, you know, speaking as a rookie, you see that you have a run, you see it's someone like Power, you want to get the job done, but, you know, you constantly have to remind yourself bigger picture. And the whole spotter and team crossover, you know, that's something my team and I had a conversation about before the race even began. It's, you know, when the car's on track, really, and if it's busy, my spotter's in full command. My strategist will talk directly to the spotter, and the spotter will relay the information to me. That way we just don't have that crossover, because, you know, so much is happening so quickly in Texas that no one really has a chance to speak. So I think, you know, it's just kind of miscommunication between those guys. So I see it from each end. You know, I hate it for Power, I hate it for Zach. He seemed to be having a good race, but, you know, it's just one of those moments of, you know, understanding risk versus reward and that portion of the race, you know.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, to be clear, I'm not taking Zach to task. I mean, the kid was charging like heck. I mean, he was on pace potentially for his best IndyCar finish to date. You know, he was flirting around top six at the time. Again, at least is how I saw it. I know that there was a communication breakdown with Power's team. I just, you know, at least the way I saw it, it looked like young Mr. DeMello might not have read the situation clearly. And funny you mention about too many voices, Zach. Texas is the one place where I've been yelled at by a driver over the radio for that exact thing. I think it might have been, I don't remember whether it was the 97, the inaugural Texas IndyCar race with our driver Greg Ray, or maybe the year after. But I was trying to tell him something from the timing stand, probably about fuel mileage or whatever. Our spotter, I think, was trying to tell him something. We might have had our team manager trying to tell him something. And, you know, we're all professionals. You try and get along. It was just really strange for me hearing a driver doing 220-something into turn one going, "Everybody shut up. I don't want everybody, one voice, only one person talking to me at once. And you guys on pit lane, shut up. And Marshall, shut up." And I'm like, hey, got a shout out here. You know, it wasn't just a guys, it was, you know, everybody shut up, and you particular Pruitt. I was embarrassed to death and was hoping that, you know, no one else was listening in on our frequency. But regardless, oh man, I wish I had that audio. I would use that so constantly, because yeah, I turned beet red. But he was completely right. I mean, we were also a young enough team.
It's tough.
No, but you drive for Andretti Autosport. That's a championship winning. That's as, you know, experienced a team as you can get. I'm not saying we're a bunch of idiots, but we were an Indy Lights team that had been doing a little, you know, barely a year into IndyCar, and we're kind of making it up as we went. So it was kind
of
nice.
Some of my favorite advice I've ever been given this year comes from Garrett and my engineer. And, you know, I always try to, like, think through, like, how the race is going to go. And, you know, we think we're maybe at Barber for, like, the second day on Monday. And I was coming up with a scenario. I was like, well, what if this happens? And what, you know, what if we have this problem? And he looks at me and he goes, you know, Smokey, only you can prevent forest fires. And I'm like, you know, I like that, because it's like, at the end of the day, it's really, you know, even in like Zach's situation and power situation, it's, we're the only ones that can prevent the forest fire. So at the end of the day, it is in your hands.
Oh, that is quadruple awesome, my man. Well, let's get into the best part of every episode, and that is our listener questions, our listener Q&A that comes in. As we do with every episode, we start off by looking back to last week's episode and picking my favorite question that came in. So our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com can send them either a Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirt of their choosing or a mug. And looking back through last week, we had some phenomenal questions, Zach, that were posed to Eric Bretzman, technical director, who is making you and everyone else smarter at Andretti Autosport. I also just realized I've had two Andretti Autosport people on in consecutive weeks, so I should have...
We appreciate that.
Well, yeah, I try and shuffle things up, but I guess, sorry. Let's see. I would say I really liked Bobby Rooney's question. He asked Eric, can you compare and contrast both the driving styles and the in-race mental strategic approach of Alexander Rossi and Ryan Hunter-Reay, and also asked, what is the single biggest strength of each at this stage of their careers? And I thought, it was a wonderful question, Bobby, and I thought Eric gave us some great insights about these two championship contenders. So, Bobby, shoot me a direct message on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. Give me your choice of a T-shirt or mug. If it's a T-shirt, tell me which size, and hit me with your mailing address and email address, and we will get you all sorted. So we've got 38 questions or so on Facebook, Zach. We have a dozen or so on the Twitters. I'm going to start off with the Twitters, because the first question comes in from a company that is near and dear to the two of us, and I think might be from a person we know by the name of Chris Pantani. So we got the first one in here from Team Cooper Tire, sponsor of our podcast. Says, what were some of the intangibles that the coming from the Mazda road to Indy, Zach, that benefited you the most when moving up in your career?
First off, I think it was just the partners, the Mazda of Indy has. I mean, I was on Cooper Tires for, you know, it seemed like 6-7 years. So, you know, with Cooper Tire and Mazda, obviously, they gave us all opportunities that we never would have had. So I'm extremely thankful for them. And, you know, I love going back and seeing all of them, because, you know, everyone from Cooper Tire, Mazda, even the road to Indy, you know, all the staff, I grew up with them. And, you know, it's always felt like a big family. So, you know, I appreciate, you know, the support in them. And honestly, I think the biggest thing that came from Road to Indy is, you know, one, getting all that time on the tracks that we go to and race and different series, just to kind of, you know, figure out your craft and, you know, how to pick up a track quickly. You know, Detroit and Texas were the only two tracks I've never raced on before this year. So, you know, to have only three races you're going to that are a question mark is pretty special. And I don't think too many series really give you that much time on the places that you're going to be running. And I think just relationships with the team, too. You know, it allowed me to kind of create a great relationship with Andretti Autosport. And, you know, ultimately that led me to being one of their IndyCar drivers. And, you know, to do all four steps with a single team, I mean, that's what every driver dreams of.
Oh, well, that's pulling up my heartstrings already, Zach. You better stop that. We're going to stay here on Twitter. And again, this is not pandering. We just got a lot of great questions, and I greatly appreciate folks who take the time not just to send these in, but to send in quality items to throw at us. All right. This might be for the two of us. I'll let you lead on it unless you want me to take it. Luke Reed says, you get granted the privilege of making the changes to the air kit regulations for the high-speed ovals next year. What, if anything, do you change and why? He says, what do you want to see happen at places like Indianapolis, Texas, Pocono, that we haven't seen this year? Any thoughts there, well, Zach, or you want me to take the bullets?
I'll take it. I'm probably not going to get many fans, so... I don't mean, obviously I understand the dangers and the risks, but I really do enjoy pack racing. That's what we grew up doing in Indy Lights. You know, the old car at the Freedom 100 going four wide, you know, switching positions three times a lap. To me, that's just a lot of fun. Maybe that's just because I'm really young and, you know, I haven't been around this sport for that long. But, you know, I'd like to see the sidewalls on at Texas so we can all go, you know, two by two. And, you know, how Fontana raced a few years ago. To me, that is oval racing. That's what I grew up watching, and that's what I love. But I do understand why we are where we're at now. And honestly, I like what we have now because it's really hard. Not having the downforce, lifting, you know, it brings in a whole new prospect of racing where you have to really plan ahead and think ahead how to – you know, how to time your lift just right so you can get the power to try to get a good run off the corner. So it's definitely harder now. I think with the downforce off, it's making better drivers out of us. But to me, you know, I like the show of having, you know, a bit of a back.
The feedback that I gave a person that I asked at IndyCar was, I think a little bit more downforce, and that might be another thing that doesn't bring fans, but, you know, downforce seemingly has become the instant bad guy. You mentioned downforce, ooh, bad. It isn't bad. But there are ways of producing it and amounts that, you know, are either too much or too little. I've heard enough drivers that I respect, veterans who've been doing this in all type of configuration, who've said, you know, at Texas, after Texas, we had a little bit more downforce. I think we might have degraded the tires a little bit less. We could have run side by side a little bit more. I look at things kind of from the inverse of what we saw. So what we had, by and large, Zach, is we did have folks, your teammate Alexander Rossi, again, doing his frickin' ridiculous routine of, you know, he even passed himself. All right, that's how fast he was. I mean, the guy was just passing everyone and everything in sight. But what we had, with exception of a few drivers who could go around and get by people constantly, we've had a situation where at Texas in particular, through the weird combination we spoke of, heat, tire life, etc., with the blistering, we would essentially have folks either falling off because their cars were not competitive, there was something setup-wise that didn't work, so they lost speed, went backwards. Or we had cars that were good for a little bit, passed another one, maybe, let's say, towards the front, but then both of their cars, or most of those cars, then degraded and couldn't get back around one another. So you have either car falling out of the window, driver struggling, goes down a lap, whatever it is, falls backwards. Or B, you have the, okay, I'm feeling good, and I got by you for first or second or whatever, but the ability, most of the time, for that driver in second to then, you know, work and work and work, and 5, 10, 20 laps later, get back around, bit of a rarity. And so when I look at that, I look at Indy and say, kind of the same thing, right? Couple of drivers, you know, Rossi yet again, Servia, Rahal, couple of drivers who were the anomaly, who were just doing crazy passes, but the bulk of the cars on track kind of either stuck in that miss the window, falling backwards, uncompetitive, or I might get around you, but boy, we're all kind of stuck a little bit into the run. And then we go back to Phoenix, and it's, again, kind of the same tune. So I've seen three oval races, 1 mile, 2.5 miles, and 1.5 miles, where fairly similar scripts have played out, Zach, of downforce reduction, aero wash being a pretty big thing causing understeer, and a couple cars that were the anomalies, the majority that could go forward a little bit but then kind of get stuck, and then some others that fell off and were uncompetitive. If you compare that to the pack racing, like you mentioned, I don't know if I want to go back to that the way it was, but if we could just ratchet up the ability for maybe some of the lead cars to be a little bit more competitive instead of single file for most of their stint, that's my concern. I think IndyCar is on the verge of what was up until recently its most thrilling presentation. IndyCars on an oval. Holy cow, I have to see this. Not saying it's bad. I'm truly not, but it that entertainment value has been dialed down enough, I think, that we're now really looking to road and street courses for the excitement. That would be a big change.
And I think I couldn't have said it more perfect myself. I mean, I think, yeah, just that little bit of the middle ground would be great. But, you know, one thing that this new car does is it really benefits having the perfect setup. You know, I think we missed it at Indy and we were stuck in that line all day and you really can't get much done.
Yeah.
And then Texas, you know, we were one of the lucky few that had a car that we could pass pretty much anywhere. And when you have that good car, it feels like you have an extra 50 horsepower. I mean, it's crazy how more clear the game becomes to you and how you can start, you know, picking people off a lot easier. But, you know, I think a lot of it, you know, comes down to now is just whoever specs the, you know, the best mechanical package, because that's where all of our grip's coming from now. You know, if you have that car that kind of rotates well mid-corner off, you know, you're going to be able to pass. But if you have that car that's light on the front end, you can never get off the corner flat and you're kind of just stuck back there.
So I know this is just the one true black art, mysterious science for IndyCar to try and get right. So nothing that I've said was, you know, honestly, Zach, intended in a bad way towards IndyCar.
Yeah, no,
it's
exactly.
Just, you know, they're trying to work from what they think is going to be the right thing. I would say that after three oval races, they might have enough data in hand to decide whether they stick with this course of action on downforce philosophy, or if dialing it up a little bit, I don't know what that is, 5%, 10%, something, might be, you know, something worth considering when we turn up in July at Iowa.
But hey, at the end of the day, you know, it's all the same for everyone, and it's fun having to figure it out. But even if IndyCar said, you know what, we're going to take all the wings off and you guys are going to have to go out there and figure out how to drive it, you know, I'd still be having fun. I mean, get to say you're driving an IndyCar is one of the coolest things in the world.
No, definitely. I'm just thinking bigger picture of I want people to want to watch you drive that car.
Yeah,
and if
exactly.
If the formula is off, they won't. Let's see. Gene says, with Andretti's McLaren connection, what are the chances of you making a Friday practice session in a Formula One McLaren MCL 33 chassis? Come on, Zach, break some news here for us.
I mean, I'd love to. I don't even know if that's like even on the table or existing, but I'm probably going to bring it up now.
Yes, Stoffel Van Dorn, you're done, buddy.
I appreciate the question, but I mean, yeah, that'd be awesome. I think for me, I was kind of on the side of I always dreamt of driving IndyCar when I was little. You know, I thought Formula One was, you know, always exciting and cool, but you know, to me, the heartland was IndyCar. That's what I wanted. But I definitely would like to say I've driven an F1 car, you know, just at least once at some point.
Well, I wish I had the influence to make that happen, but I don't, but I can talk about it. All right,
perfect.
Couple more great ones on Twitter before we jump over to Facebook here. Let's see. John Scheidler. This is a really sharp one for you, Zach, and I'll admit, John, this might be a little bit early for a guy who's halfway through his rookie season. How do you balance the expectations of performing against your experienced teammates on a top team like Andretti with the importance of being conservative, learning, and completing laps? He said, it seems like it's working well so far, but is that truly a balance that you know, implement and work? Or are you doing the best you can and you would love to be beating your teammates if you could right now, but maybe that's too much to ask halfway through your rookie season.
Well, I mean, that's a great question. Trust me, it is a big chunk of pride when, you know, you out-qualify a teammate for me right now because you know how good they are. But that's one position that I'm extremely lucky to be in with Andretti is, you know, with it being a three-year deal and Michael really understanding how I learn and how I perform. I mean, he saw that in Indy Lights. We had our first year in Lights was very up and down. Our second year, we almost won a championship. And he understands how I work. So honestly, the expectations and the pressure isn't very high this year. You know, from my teammates, from my engineer to my teammates' engineers, they're all telling me, you know, how good of a job I'm doing. And, you know, they see the progression from each week to the next. And I'm, you know, excited to actually provide, you know, important feedback as far as setup changes and whatnot to my teammates. And it's a good position to be in. You know, I don't feel any pressure at all from the team. All the pressure I feel is on myself. And that's just, you know, obviously me wanting to do the best I can and learn as quickly as I can. So there's no other place I'd want to be than where I'm at right now.
Oh, well, again, well, you're pulling on the heart. You got to stop pulling, Zach. It's going to come out.
It's a family. We're cousins.
Josette Torres. This is it's a great question. Well, the second part I'm going to ask you about, definitely. Do you have a post-racing plan yet? Or are you too wrapped up in racing to think about that? So that's the first question. I'm going to ask the second one in a moment.
Yeah, I think... you know, obviously, at the end of a long tenured career with a lot of achievement, Chavez and I both have kind of joked about starting a team. That would be a lot of fun. But if that's not it, you will find me living out of a van and rock climbing every single day in Yosemite Valley. That would be
down be by a river. Oh, that is so awesome! Wow. The second question: and when do you get the fire tattoo to honor this year's Indy 500 ride? I've never asked you. I'm hoping you don't have any tattoos, but do you? And if so, would you get a toasty Indy 500 depicted on your car?
You know, I've gone a really long time without people knowing this, but why not? I do have a tattoo.
Oh, if it's a tramp stamp, you and I are going to have
It's about an inch long, and it's on my foot because I climbed Half Dome. And long story short, I kind of went on a vacation with Chavez and all of them down to Florida. We were not making great decisions, and we were all like, hey, let's go get tattoos. And for some reason, I thought putting it on my foot was the best place to get it. And, so there it is.
Wow. All right. Well, you know.
Now the world knows.
Now the world knows. I'm hoping your dad or your mom, you know, hoping your parents aren't finding out for the first time. Zach, what have you done to yourself?
The funny story is I called my dad, and I was like, hey, I got a tattoo. And he literally paused for the longest period I've ever heard him pause in his entire life. And from that point on, I was kind of scared.
Well, if you told him you had a complete back piece done of Elton John or something, that might have been. All right, so
Says Tiny Dancer.
See? You're the best. We're going to close out Twitter here. Elizabeth Worth asks a very salient question. How does it feel to contain so much badass in a mere 5.5 feet, Zach Veach?
Oh, it feels incredible. The thing that I love is there's an article that just came out a little bit ago, and I was reading through it. I can't remember if it was on Racer or IndyCar, but they talked about my choir boy appearance. So, you know, if I can look, you know, young and innocent and go out and, you know, kick some ass, I appreciate that, because that's like having the best of both worlds. People aren't afraid of you, and then you give them the right to be.
Meow, listen to that. Arr, like a dungeon dragon. All right, Zach Veach is going off. Oh, well, we learned from Gabby Chavez that, you know, all of his taekwondo, you know, he's definitely ready to unleash that on somebody's head if need be. So,
I'm sure.
You roll around with him. You'll add in some of the things there that we need. All right, we're going to switch over to Facebook here, and we might have to go into a little bit of overtime. Is that okay, Zach?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. I'm genuinely just trying to pick where we start because there's just a crazy amount of goodness here. Let's see. Comes in from Joel Swaim. Zach, suppose you have taken a sponsor who'll give you all the money in the world, but you can't take it to IndyCar. Where else are you going with it?
Ooh. Can I do a...
You can do whatever you want.
Money in the world?
This is whatever you want.
Yeah, probably, like, you know, running the European Le Mans Series with a side garage for a wing sprint car. That would be my team.
How about a World Endurance Championship program with the winged sprint car?
Yeah, that's itself. What I meant. Yeah, there we go.
Yes, I don't know if Michelin makes grooved sprint car tires, but we are going to.
It would be great in the rain. That's all I can say.
Good man. All right, Ben Cohen. This is again. I like this because this is more getting, you know, the insight of who you are. Ben says, Zach, as a man of smaller, he says, stature, myself, I think Ben meant stature, I get somewhat perplexed by all the broadcaster's obsession with your size. Does it ever get on your nerves? Or are you just a bigger man than that, than I am about this kind of stuff? Keep up the good work this season.
I want to just say I appreciate every single one of you fans that have come out and said, we get it. He's small. Why is it, you know, talked about every single weekend? Because that's how I feel. I think probably Tracy, he's been the one that's talked about it the most.
He's had a lot of concussions, so he forgets what he's said.
But I think it's funny. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, that's like always the first thing that they bring up. And I'm like, you know, DeMarta was really good. And if we're standing next to each other, we're probably the same size. So.
You could dunk on DeMata, actually.
Okay,
so
perfect. So, you know, that's the way. Yeah, it does get old a little bit, but, you know, the one next to that is always explaining how old I am. That one happens a ton.
Yeah, you need to improve that, because when people ask you, you hold up your one hand, you go, I'm this many. And, you know, so you got to change that.
I do have to tell, we were in the parade for the 500, and this guy comes up, and he's like, can I see your driver's license? And I just shout back, and I'm like, well, can I see your AARP card? And everyone, like, laughed, and this guy, like, was not too happy, so I think I won.
All right, good. Well, yeah, you didn't get hit with an egg in the head when you're pulling away there.
Exactly.
All right. Robbie Bergren says, hi, Zach. What was the number one thing you learned from this past weekend at Texas? And I would insert other than proper hydration.
Yes. Good question. The thing I took away more than anything is if you have a good car and you know that you have a good car, don't rush it. You know, I think we had a bit of a slow stop at the end of the first stint. And obviously we had a car that could keep us up at the front. When we came back out in like 12th or 11th, you know, I was so eager to get back up there and I was pushing so hard that I took ourselves out of the race. So I think, you know, a more experienced guy at that point would have been like, okay, I'm just going to settle in here, wait for these guys to peel off, maybe, you know, make some better fuel mileage to go a lap further than they can. And then I'll put myself back to where I need to be for the third stint. I've laid in bed, you know, thinking about that the past three nights, and it's kind of been keeping me up. So I think that's the one thing that I've learned most is just if you have something good, take care of it and take your time. You know, you don't have to be at the front till the end.
Henri Fawn asks, Zach, what surprised you the most, either positively or negatively, in entering IndyCar full time this season? And kind of on that similar vein, is there anything that exceeded your expectations or turned out to be a major disappointment?
No disappointments, really. I think everything has just kind of blown me away because this is something you dream about for so long. The one thing that really, you know, blew me away is just the level of competition. I mean, I know that shouldn't even be a question, but, you know, when you get into these cars and you look at how one little tiny mistake can be the separation between, you know, being first and being 18th, it really kind of gives you a whole perspective of appreciation. You know, when these guys go out to qualify, I think that's been the toughest thing is, you know, in lights with the Cooper tires, you have five or six laps to put that perfect lap together. In IndyCar, you have a single lap to get it done. And before that lap, you only had two laps on a set of laps to get it done. So you know, you're leaving pit lane and you're just switching it on right then, and you have to get the job done right there. I think that's been the toughest thing, just because you're still learning and trying to figure out where to push. But that one lap sometimes isn't always optimized.
Brandon Smith, similar. I like this. A lot of folks are wanting to go for the ride with you as a rookie to see what you're learning. Brandon Smith asks, Zach, at one point in the Texas race, you're able to follow your teammate Alexander Rossi around for several laps. He says, what did you learn most from him about racing at Texas or oval racing in general? That also opens a question of, is Alex someone within the team who you look to or kind of helps as a mentor?
Oh, for sure. I actually just had lunch with Alex about 2 hours ago, and we were running through the weekend, and he was kind of giving me what he took away from it. And, you know, for me, Alex was racing for position, and he needed the clean air, so I didn't want to pass and, you know, take that air away from him. So I was just kind of sitting back there and honestly just practicing my timing, as silly as that sounds, but you know, I didn't have pressure from behind, and I think Alex was saving a little bit of fuel, so I just kept dropping back and trying to get the perfect run through one and two to have the best timing through three and four to pop out and pass for the finish line. So I was just kind of playing and learning as much as I could in that position, because, you know, that's about all I could gain there, if that makes sense.
So we got a couple questions, technical in spirit or in specifics. Got a couple from Norm Nelson asking about what parts teams are allowed to manufacture, any of them carbon parts and pieces. There's not a ton that teams have been opened up and allowed to do. Most of it's on the metal side, Norm, compared to doing big carbon things on their own. But let me shift here to maybe a more performance-related item on this subject from Adam Sharp. He says, if IndyCars are primarily a spec car, are there any parts or components a team can purchase, create to customize it, and then set themselves higher in the pack, or does it all come down to setup? Well, the answer to that, Adam, is although IndyCar and the competition department have opened up more areas and will continue to open more areas that teams can, you know, make their own brake pedals, for example, which was once, you know, not allowed, and some other, almost term them as ancillary parts, the one key area that's been open since day one with this Dallara DW12 is shocks, the dampers themselves. And that is, as Zach will tell you, the biggest, really, the one giant area where teams can differentiate themselves. You can not only buy shocks from different manufacturers, but also what goes inside those shocks, wide open, pretty much do as you please. And this is a case where your team in particular, Zach, just 2 years ago or so, was really out to lunch at many road and street courses. And your damping program started to come on strong last year, and this year has really, really been impressive. But Adam, to answer your question, and Zach, maybe you can fill in a little bit more from your end, but truly, damping is the one key area, the good old shock absorbers, where a team that is kicking butt one weekend and other teams that might be out to lunch, you can probably look at something in the damping areas having a bigger portion of why they're either doing well or why they're off than you might expect.
Yeah, and just to touch on to that, I mean, everything Marshall said is spot on. And you know, the damper program is such an important part of an Indy car. I mean, I kind of look at it as, you know, if you want to think of it in home use, look at it as like shoe inserts. You know, it's something that you go run a marathon as in, isn't something that you would take to a business meeting. And that's basically the difference of tracks that we go to. And, you know, Andretti has done such a good job that, you know, we have so many different damper plots that we go over to basically show the curve of how the damper works, you know, on entry, middle of the corner, and exit, that, you know, we basically call it flavors. And it's not so much, you know, one flavor is superior to the other, even though some are, but a lot of it just comes down to what flavor the driver wants. You know, how do you like the car to release itself in the middle of the corner, you know, and so on and so on. So, you know, a lot of it just comes down to having that equipment there at your disposal to try, and then the driver going out and try to figure out what he likes. You know, there's been a couple dampers that I've preferred all season long. It just seems like every time we go to them, I'm like, yep, these are the ones. And you can't really say that's track specific. specific, really. You know, that's more driver specific there.
All right, we're gonna wind down here, Zach, with a couple. And again, I'm thank you to everybody who sent these in, and apologies for those we didn't get to, but we are firmly and squarely blaming Zach Veach. Be less popular, be less likable, and see, we'd only have like 3 questions. They'd all be, Zach, why are you such a jerk? Don Gregory. All right, I like this. Which current or former driver have you tried to pattern your career after? And I guess it also starts out with, Zach, is there a driver you look to and say, aha, that's a model for me to follow?
It hasn't really been a model per se, just because, you know, I was part of the first iteration in the very first year of the Mazda Road to Indy, if you want to say that. You know, I hope in another 10 years there's some drivers that modeled their careers after me. But I think as far as how a driver's perceived or how, you know, a driver conducts himself on the track and off, I think I've followed, you know, I've tried to look to guys like Dario Franchitti, you know, Dixon, even James, when it comes to, you know, handling people. And, you know, there's so many positives in the IndyCar paddock that you can kind of look around and, you know, just see, you know, who's the best at what they're doing. And that can kind of inspire you to, you know, be like them in a way, you know. To have Dixon's, you know, closing ability and Dario's precision and, you know, James' outgoingness, I think, you know, that's a pretty good combination.
Oh, Jesus, that would be the most horrible monster ever.
But yeah, it'd be ugly.
Now I understand why you're growing your hair out, trying to have that lavish, those lavish Scottish locks like Dario.
Well, that was last year. I tried, it didn't work, yeah. So I had to cut it up.
All right. I think we have, this might be a lock for question of the week winner, and there's 2 of them in there, one where I get to embarrass myself, which is something I thoroughly enjoy. James Litticote says, Zach, okay, sort of similar to recently asked question, which went to Kyle Kaiser about which Star Wars character he would be, if you were one of Marvel's Avengers, who would you be, and who else from the paddock would you have with you, and who would they be?
Oh, that's a good one. I think I'd want to be, I'd probably be the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy. What's his name? Star-Lord? Yeah,
yes.
Star-Lord.
Oh, okay.
Him, I don't know, I'd say Rossi. He's pretty funny. He could be Deadpool.
Rossi is Deadpool. Keep it going. You're on it here.
Fine. I guess I gotta have my teammates in there, right? So
unless you don't like him, I mean,
probably be like Iron Man.
He is not Iron Man. I mean,
who would be Iron Man?
Well, I mean, Hunter Ray would probably naturally be Captain America, but it seems a little too predictable.
I didn't think about that. That's fair.
That might be a little too on the nose, though.
Yeah, but I don't think Marco's Iron Man. I don't. See, that's tough. I'm going to stick with Star-Lord Deadpool. That'd be fun.
Okay, yeah, but we do need to figure out. I mean, Hunter Ray could be Captain America, but who else could he be?
That's a tough one.
Yeah, would Marco be like Nightcrawler? I don't know.
And to go off topic, Guardians of the Galaxy movies are my absolute favorite, and it's not because of the movie, it's the soundtrack that's associated with each movie.
Well, good man, I like that.
If you start a movie off with Mr. Blue Sky, it's going to be my favorite for life.
I am loving the fact that you are appreciating the music of my childhood, Zach Veach.
I'm an old soul, man. What can I say?
Good. They clearly, the Veach family line, strong Midwestern roots. I love this. And then James says for me, he says, Marshall, in your episode of Who the Hell Are You? You answered death by cheeseburger. That was my final question. If you're sentenced to death by BJ or cheeseburger, which would you choose? I chose cheeseburger. Not a surprise if you look at my physique. So James said, I'm wondering, was there a specific cheeseburger or restaurant you had in mind? My love for cheeseburgers came from my father, who would make them at home with this very unique recipe. I'm also realizing, Zach, that on a topic involving BJs, I'm probably not going to go too much further in bringing my father into the conversation. So, I think it's a little bit of a chain. I don't know if it's how much it's reached across the country, but I can tell you that part of my weight gain can be blamed on a local joint here in the Bay Area called The Counter.
And, The Counter.
Yeah, The Counter. And it's kind of a gourmet hamburger place. And my wife knows, anytime I come home from a somewhat extended trip covering a race, not like Texas, which is just, you know, essentially a two-day, but if I'm gone for 4 or 5 days and come home, I might order something from The Counter as a bit of a reward. So, A, I clearly need to stop rewarding myself because it's not helping. But, James, to answer your question, The Counter is certainly a place where if you love hamburgers and cheeseburgers and you were going to die, that might be the place where you ordered from.
I'm going to have to go there, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Let's pick one or two more here and then bid farewell to this episode, Zach. Keith Lee says, question for me, says, can you spend a few minutes, might not be minutes, recalling the kart race that never happened at Texas Motor Speedway back in 2001? This part has come up, Zach, from a few people that have asked regarding the speeds that we have seen this year and last year. Are there any concerns that might happen again, especially when the new engine regulations come into play a couple years from now when we have 900 to 1,000 horsepower? The big issue there, Keith, was not straight line speed. It was the continuation of that straight line speed through the corners. So I'm stating something that, you know, those of you who know about the race, it's a fairly obvious statement. The Indy Racing League visited Texas, kicked off the inaugural event in 97. And while those cars had, I'm thinking 650, 700 horsepower, maybe peak, didn't have a ton of downforce. The tires were good, especially the ones from Firestone. The Goodyears are also good, but the Firestones were really unique. But those cars were not rockets in a straight line to make getting to the corners and then maintaining that crazy amount of speed, Zach, something where the G-forces were just overwhelming the drivers' bodies, and some were starting to black out or on the verge, you know, getting vertigo. It was brutal forces of throwing, you know, cars, the kart, Indy cars then at, you know, whatever the number was, 240 miles an hour into the banking at turn one. And your whole body just goes, ugh. And then you're going so fast down the straightaways and maintaining it again into three where there's no recovery time. And so the event had to be called off because drivers just were overwhelmed by the forces, which spoke to the ferocity of that era of car. Keep in mind, we're talking 2001. This is when Gilles DeFerrin set the closed course lap record in qualifying at Fontana at 241 mile an hour average. So these are true beasts in terms of engines, plus very good grip as well. What we have now, which, you know, as you can attest to, Zach, we have cars that go through the corners very, very quickly. They're not necessarily rockets, yeah, kart-style rockets down the straights. So I don't have any concerns about this happening again right now. But great question, Keith, and something I know that IndyCar is going to have to think about deeply, that when we do get back up to these kart-like numbers, is that something that they would allow at Texas? Or is this something where they would do like we have now and turn down the boost on the you know, the bigger speedways, so that we don't flirt with those kind of forces? So when you're talking about drivers, IndyCar drivers in particular, who I rate among the bravest of any racers on the planet, when their bodies are surrendering in the corners because they cannot deal with the forces in mind, that just tells you that we have gone a step too far. I have to believe plenty of us will be telling IndyCar to learn from that lesson in 2001 when we get back up to these big power numbers.
Yeah, for sure. I saw I think Tracy, he posted a picture on his Instagram, and it was the practice speeds around Texas, and just looking at those numbers alone, I can't imagine what kind of ride that must have been. I mean, I think I heard, you know, it might have been Kanaan or someone else that was talking about when they were running there, that he was beside a car on the back straightaway. It might not have been Kanaan, but a driver was by a car on the back straightaway, and he said, I couldn't tell where my car began and, like, his car ended, just because they were so dizzy from coming out of the corner. And when you have that, I think, you know, you're asking for a lot, especially in that era of car.
That's not, well, and I'm not saying this, you know, to sound the alarm, but that's no longer motor racing. You're purely in survival mode at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
When you are dizzy and confused at 240 and there are hard walls awaiting you, that is definitely no bueno. All right, last question or two, then we are going to ship this episode down the road, Zach Veach. This one comes in from Corey Matthews. It says, during the season, can you describe a week in the life? So what is a week in the life for Zach Veach while we're in the middle of the IndyCar Championship?
Let's go with the past week that I had. I mean, I think that's the best way to do it. It's basically the end of a five-week journey. So, you know, you're at Indy all month of May. You have the road course, you have the Indy 500, so you're spending a lot of time in a bus. Even though that you live in Indy, you just kind of want to have your own space to kind of get in the mindset. You go to Detroit the weekend after Indy, so you're a little tired but excited to, you know, start turning right again. You get through Detroit weekend, which is a doubleheader, so, you know, one IndyCar race in itself is really hard on your body, but to do one and then one back-to-back right after that on Sunday. On the car ride home Sunday night back to your home in Indiana, you're extremely worn out. You sleep until about noon on Monday, and you find a way to make it to the gym. And then Tuesday, you train, go to the shop, kind of debrief how the Detroit weekend went, try to, you know, debrief to prepare for Texas. Wednesday, you start building a fish tank. And then you go training again. And Thursday morning at 6 a.m., you get up, you go to the airport, you fly on the IndyCar charter out to Texas, you land around noon, and you go straight to In-N-Out Burger, and then you go to the racetrack and start preparing for the weekend. And you're there Friday, Saturday, you fly back Saturday night, and you're back home for a few more hours.
Can I tell you how bad of a job you just did at selling how tough the life is? You know, I mean, come on. I had to dig a 400-foot ditch. I started a new dog manure business, hands deep in that. Then I just got whipped and beaten because that's part of my contract. I mean, come on, Zach. You're making this sound too much fun.
Well, the training is really hard. I just didn't go into, you know, how it's, you train for about 4 hours every single day, and you throw up after some of them. So, you know, that's the rough part of the life for sure.
All right, good, good, good. Well, let's close here on something we kind of foreshadowed a little bit, and you're welcome to provide any feedback you like to your sponsor at Group 1001. Final question goes to Cody Bray, who says, do you get a lot of jokes about your car looking like a Cheeto bag?
Well, I think the Cheeto bag honestly helped me at Texas, because everyone saw the Cheeto bag coming through. You know, when you see a bright orange and yellow in your mirror, you kind of think that you're on fire. So you look at it and you're like, oh, it's not a fire, it's a car. So I think that helped. But yes, you know, we started off with the Group 1001 car, which is a holding company for several insurance firms here in Indiana. We had that through Barber and Indy Road Course, and now we're in the Relay car. And Relay is basically a prepaid credit card that earns you cash back on everything that you purchase with it. So it's for the type of people who like to spend their money monthly strategically. So the first year you get, you know, 3% back on whatever you buy with it. As you're with the company longer, by the time you get to year 7, you're getting 13% back on everything you're buying with it. So it helps to be with it. We'll be in this car through the Mid-Ohio weekend, and then we'll be back to the Group 1001 car, I believe. So we'll have the Cheeto bag car for a little bit longer.
Well, and I gotta push back a little here. You did a horrible job explaining there, Zach, because the one thing you didn't tell folks, the most important part, is the Relay card, which is the same day glowish yellow and orange, you can actually eat, because it is essentially a very thin Cheeto. So if you get hungry, your credit card is also a digestible food item. So pretty innovative stuff there. Very
and
important.
And if you want to channel my inner Indy 500, go ahead and light up your grill.
Yes.
Put a card on it for about 30 seconds, and it'll soften it up for you as well.
Zach is just saying take out like 20 of the credit cards. That's all he's saying, you know, and throw them on the grill. You know, man, you're a heck of a salesman here. All right, well, Zach, again, as I tell folks, look, I am a professional motor racing reporter, et cetera, et cetera. I try to be as professional as possible with my podcast, but this, you know, we're not winning Pulitzer Prizes. This is just hopefully meant to be a little bit insightful, hopefully somewhat entertaining, and I mention all that because, you know, greatly appreciate you, Zach, and what you bring to the sport already. And again, I know if this was a normal interview, I wouldn't be saying such nice things to you, but again, it's my podcast, so I'll say whatever I want. I'm appreciative of you willfully taking the time here in a week where you're just wanting to shut down a little bit and rest after a really busy stretch. But I hope, as folks have heard, you bring a lot of character, a lot of fun, and a lot of honesty to what you do. So I think it's one of the reasons, if not the primary reason, why we've got 8,000 questions that have come in, because folks seem to like what you're doing. So thanks again for bringing that to our sport, but also to my little podcast here presented by Cooper Tires.
No, thank you so much. I mean, Marshall, I think it goes without saying, all of us appreciate what you guys and what Racer does for us, especially the guys that are coming up the road to Indy, because, you know, a lot of people don't know anything about us until, you know, they start seeing us in some articles. So I appreciate that. And to all the fans, especially the ones who sent in the questions, I have been completely blown away this year by the amount of people that have come up to me and just, you know, have become fans of mine. So to me, that is extremely cool, because I was a fan long before I ever thought about being a race car driver. So I really, really appreciate that. And hopefully, you know, we can do this for a long time and, you know, keep building the fans as we go.
Amen. And on that topic, keep building your fish tank. I want to see photos on Twitter or something. And enjoy yourself until we get back on the road here in a little over a week. And go play in the Kettle Moraine Valley at Road America. Zach, thanks again for joining us on the Weekend IndyCar on the Marshall Pro Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires.